This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Smitra Selvaraj. Today we're tackling the topic of teen pregnancies. Why are children birthing children? It's a tough question to answer, and often the answer is mired in social and cultural taboos. But it is a question that must be asked again and again until adolescents, both boys and girls, are aware of the gravitas of bringing a life into this world. Joining me in the studio today to have this conversation is Dr. Narima Owen, chairperson of the National Population and Family Development Board, better known by its Malay language acronym LPPKN, as well as social activist site Azmi Al-Habshi, who is a tireless proponent of child rights. Thank you both for being here today. So we're going to start with a question that I asked just moments ago. Why are children having children? I know the straightforward answer is because they're having sex, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on it. Dr. Narima, perhaps we'll start with you.
Why are children having children? I think the very first reason and reality we have to accept is pure biology. The hormones are there. They are driven by hormones. They want to have sex. We did too when we were young. I'm sure you did too when you were young. So the question is, how do you handle that situation? So biologically, the sexual urge is there. And we can see this even pre-biblical times, I'm sure. So what is it that situation is not under control? And I think the main overriding reason is ignorance. And this ignorance of both the parents and the child, boy or girl, himself or herself. So then you have to ask the next question, why are they ignorant? Why are we not teaching them? So we have failed to do that. I think there is enough evidence to say that parents do not teach anything about sex to the children at home. We tried to have sex education in school. I think you and I can accept the fact that it's not something that we can be proud of. I think some people even call it a colossal failure. So sex education, especially comprehensive sexual education, is not carried out optimally in this country. So that's the reason why there is ignorance among parents and among teachers. And I would go one step earlier that there is no enabling environment, social, cultural, religious, even policymakers. I mean, if you look at policy making and the law by the government, I think the environment is not really enabling. So, like, there is no clear policy. There was, but it's, again, on primary prevention as in sex education. And if the girl, maybe I shouldn't be talking about this now, I predict you will ask this question later on, once the girl gets pregnant, what is done? I think there is no enabling environment there as well.
Yeah.
And it's even worse when the girl goes for an unsafe abortion and her life gets threatened. Is there an enabling environment there as well to look after post-abortion care? So that's another step. But Sumitra, to answer your first question just now, yes, they are driven by the hormones and they are ignorant. They do not know why they must not get pregnant before they are ready and how can they stop from being pregnant.
I mean, in the course of your work, right, when you speak to pregnant teenagers, you know, what are some of the main reasons that they give you as to why they're indulging in sexual activity?
Well, first of all, most of them actually admit we don't want to get pregnant, right? So they don't want that. And then it's totally become a total social isolation. But when we talk about sex, even the definition of sex itself, they're not sure. And probably this surprises a lot of us, but the boys are a bit more aware.
Okay.
So all the methodology like condom or any methodology in not to try to get pregnant are the advices from the boys.
That's interesting.
It is very much interesting because the girl would suddenly say, "Dia kata pancut luar," you know, and when I ask her, what does it mean, right? So she doesn't, she really don't understand, like, can you control it? Do you not? So where is that conversation having place?
Right.
So one of the top reasons for girls, first, clearly I said, they don't want to get pregnant.
Okay.
But if I ask them, like, okay, you got pregnant, and these are the ones who will answer back if it's already on the 6-month pregnancy stage. If it's too early, they'll be crying still. So 6 months, they say, well, we were bored. It will just actually say that, you know, we were bored. We know that we were having sex. This is not the first time. but we didn't expect to get pregnant. So again, are we talking about getting pregnant is one thing, having sex is another thing.
Agreed.
Abstinence has a different definition.
Agreed.
So why do you have sex? It's my main question instead of why do you get pregnant, because they just don't want to. So no. There's no answer. So when I say, why do you have sex then? So they will answer, we were bored. They will also answer saying that the boy trusts us more. He loves me. He appreciates what I'm about to say. There's no boundaries in conversations. Need to prove to the parents to say that we can be responsible. So all that thing, in the end, can be manipulated by anyone, by their boyfriends, by their own peers, peer pressure, saying that we've done it, you haven't done it. And that's real, you see. So, and they thought they are being safe.
What is the prevalent perception when a teenage girl does become pregnant? What is said to her, and how does this affect how the pregnancy is handled?
This is a very, very important but rather difficult question, because we are now touching on value systems.
Yes.
And values differ so much. I'll give you a personal experience. In the year 2002, I think it was, I went to Sweden to undergo a 3-week course on adolescent sexuality, and we had a value clarification class, and the lecturer asked one of the students from Pakistan, "Ali, if your 17-year-old unmarried girl comes home and tells you she's pregnant, what do you do?" Without batting an eyelid, Ali said, "I have to kill her. I have to stone her to death." We all say, "Ali, can you please reconsider your answer?" "No, that's the answer I have to give. I live in Pakistan." The next day we asked him again, "Ali, are you not going to reconsider?" He said, "No, that's what it is in Pakistan." So when it comes to values, and I was director in the Ministry of Health, and now I'm chairman of the LPPKN, it is important for me to give this message to my service providers that your personal values are your personal values. You don't agree with premarital sex. But if an unmarried girl comes and asks for contraceptive from you, you should not put your personal value there. But Sumitra, I'm telling you, this is really not easy. You know, so that personal values come in. And of course, once you put religion into it, it becomes even much, much harder to tackle. Interestingly, because we in LPPKN, we conduct a study, unfortunately, only once in 10 years because it's too expensive to conduct. When I saw the result, that percentage astonished me at first. Only 1/3, slightly more than 30% of both boys and girls know that a girl can get pregnant on the first sexual encounter. When I asked for the sex differential, it's about the same. Boys and girls are equally ignorant. And on the next question about do you know about the protective role of condoms?
Mm-hmm.
Again, just about 1/3 of them know that. And there's both boys and girls are equally ignorant. And I think the same findings were given by the Minister of Health when they conduct their National Health and Morbidity Survey. Mm-hmm. So back to ignorance, the level of knowledge among our teenagers about sex and pregnancy is extremely low.
I think before we use the word sex to public and they start looking at you one round, I think it's also about healthy relationship and boundaries. Sumitra used the word consent just now, and that's embedded in that, because all our media would like to show this beautiful side of having a relationship.
Mm.
So some children might think that to have that relationship, I have to have sex.
Right.
So where is that?
Yeah. Well, we're going to be addressing those questions in a little bit. I'm going to take a quick break now. I'm speaking to Dr. Narima Owen, chairperson of the National Population and Family Development Board and social activist site Azmi Alhabshi, about teenagers who get pregnant. We'll be back after these messages. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Sumitra Selvaraj. I'm speaking to Dr. Narima Owen, chairperson of the National Population and Family Development Board and social activist site Azmi Alhabshi, about the rising number of adolescents who get pregnant. Now, before the break, we had a very broad strokes look at some of the reasons children engage in underage sexual activities. We're now going to go into the consequences of that activity. So in Malaysia, the current statistics seem to be about an average of 18,000 teenage girls get pregnant each year. Dr. Narima, would you concur with these numbers?
Talking of statistics is always very, very difficult to unpack and to unravel. Because number one, teenagers can be married, can be unmarried.
Mm-hmm.
I was working for the WHO, by the way, when we commissioned a study many years ago on teenage pregnancies, if I remember correctly, 17 countries contribute to 70% of teenage pregnancies in the world. None of these countries were in my region except the Philippines, and that was a very low figure. The four leading countries were America, USA and Brazil, and India and Bangladesh. And India and Nigeria, I think it was. And immediately you can say one is the Western countries. These are unmarried teenage pregnancies who are curious about sex and have liberal sex culture. Mm-hmm. The one that were married in India and Nigeria and Bangladesh as well, they were married teenagers. So we have to see that difference first. Teenage pregnancy, married and unmarried. Mm-hmm. We are most concerned about the unmarried ones. And the unmarried pregnancy, yes. We saw a news article in the newspaper recently that claimed that the numbers are dwindling. Maybe it's true. Among the married teenagers, maybe the numbers are dwindling. I think among the unmarried teenagers, we have no reason to celebrate. It is true. And I think your figure of 18,000 is not very far from the reality. Of course, I have so many different sources of statistics that give me different numbers. Sure. But when I look at all of them, your statement of 18,000 sounds very reasonable. And it's not coming down.
Do we know who these teens are? Where do they live? Are they going to school?
Okay, that's also another very, very important question. For us in the health sector, we have, because under the Sustainable Development Goals, we have to measure adolescent birth rate.
Yes.
For 1,000 adolescents in your country defined as 15 to 19 years old, how many got pregnant in the last 1 year? So we have to report that, but we do not have the profiling because registration department or Ministry of Health or LPPKN, we go mainly by numbers, except that when we do that once in 10 years, we do the study and Kementerian Kesehatan does it more regularly. If we can do something called demographic and health survey, which we have never done, which was done when I was consulting in Myanmar, then I noticed that I realized that such a survey, which costs a lot of money, then you can look at the profiling of who are these girls? Are they urban? Are they rural? Are they rich? Are they poor? What's the education status of the mother? Is the mother working or not? What's her knowledge? So there'll be a lot, almost limitless variables you can study. Mm. Unfortunately, even the DHS that was so comprehensive that we did in Myanmar did not address teenage pregnancy. And I think that's one of the underlying things that we have to live with, that even among policymakers, they don't like to deal with sensitive issues like teenage pregnancy. Let's avoid it. Mm-hmm. Let's sweep it under the carpet kind of thing. So I think this is something that I wish the Malaysian government, either through the Ministry of Health or through my Ministry of Women, Family and Community Development, can start thinking about this. The next time we talk about teenage pregnancy, let's go beyond the numbers. These are not statistics. These are girls who have a face, who have a name, more importantly, who have a future. And why are we not studying them enough so that we can really formulate effective strategies? So I think that's something that is lacking. We do not have the profile of teenage pregnancy, except maybe urban, rural, and by the states, that's all we have.
Well, in my experience, it's only less than 300 girls that I've passed by in my life that they are pregnant, unmarried pregnant. Mm-hmm. More than half are no longer in school. Okay, so they are not in school. So I've made a personal mission 2 years ago to actually work on girls, children who are not in the system, meaning above 12, who is no longer in school. That is my activism has been working hard on, because all the others, I know the government agency can go through schools. Mm. But what about the one that is not in school? So a lot of my work has been trying to identify this group. So one of it is they are mostly not in school. They're already working. Okay. Actually, the boyfriend age is less than 5 years age gap. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And at least when we ask why they are not in school, the word is they are not interested. Mm. So to me, I like when girls answer they're not interested means that they love learning. It's just school doesn't work for them.
So you mentioned that the partners of these pregnant teens, specifically the ones that you've worked with, the 300, tend to be within 5 years or so of their age. Do these boys or young men who come in understand the gravitas of fatherhood?
Well, sometimes I wonder, are you here because you are guilty or are you here because you don't want to be reported? So we ask them that. Most of them say that, I've been with her for more than 2 years, I think, or even though it's 6 months or a year, they claim that they love her. And the girl gave permission to meet up if they can. So the word responsible is a word that they thought they understand, but they don't. So when we gave examples, so they would answer, what do you understand being a father? Diapers and milk powders. And I said, okay, how much does it cost? So they can actually say, I got a sister, this much I have to prepare. But when we talk about, what about time? What about you? What about your own future? Mm-hmm. What is your ambition? And then they start to look down. So you see, I understand a lot of family think that the boy should be punished. But if it's something that they believe, suka sama suka, it's a bit more delicate. Especially for below 18, I tend to see both as victims of circumstances and I need to save both.
Are these teenagers who are pregnant getting adequate antenatal care?
I think logically we can suspect they are not. The Ministry of Health has data, but it doesn't have a baseline. So they have numbers of teenage girls who are pregnant, married and unmarried, by the way, who come to the clinic, but we don't know how many are there out there. So we don't really have that coverage rates.
Right.
I like the question you asked Syed Azmi earlier on, Sumitra, about the gravitas of fatherhood. And I think this is one of the things that we inherit from previous years, that motherhood has been so emphasized, has been so celebrated, as it were, but not so much fatherhood. And one of the things that I want to talk to my Director General in LPPKN, I have requested this. I want to see the evaluation report of the Cafe 18. How much impact has this Cafe 18 had? And I think I would like them to pay more attention to fatherhood. These boys who come. Do you know what it means to be a father? Because, you know, I think we're not. I suspect we're not paying enough attention to it. Yes, we do to some extent.
Okay, so going back to these pregnant teenagers, right? Do we know what happens to adolescent pregnancies? Are they, in your experience, are they carried to term?
In my experience, yes, they do. And I would like to say that any girls who actually goes to Klinik Kesihatan, right? To them, they are very satisfied with the service.
Okay.
Okay? They feel safe. I think, of course, the first few visits is going to be difficult. And then it's going to be fine. And a lot of group actually look into UNICEF first 1,000 days. Means that you get pregnant until the end of 1,000 days, that will be around 2 years old of the baby. That one, we see that these girls after that, they are, of course, poverty is still there. But job is hard to come by if they don't have family support. But the babies are still with them.
Okay.
To me, I see that as important.
Yes.
And if you see the babies and the baby's healthy and all that, to me, I think that, okay, wonderful, you've done it. Because I have to also to give the opportunity if they don't want to and they cannot cope and all that and they would like to put up for adoption, it's also an option. It's just that what we advocate to a lot of group doing halfway home is to try and persuade and please try to get the birth cert for the child before putting up for adoption. We don't want they just give it out away without any documentation that will cause a different set of problem. And that part of not being judged, it's also need to be tweaked a bit.
Okay. Yeah. Dr. Narima, is abortion an option when you take into consideration the physical and mental well-being of a pregnant child, let's say below the age of 12?
Okay. Let me start the full story about abortion. As a medical doctor, as a public health specialist, to me, if I look at abortion as a medical problem, I would want to have primary prevention, secondary prevention, tertiary prevention. primary prevention, not to have an abortion simply means not to have an unwanted pregnancy. So you have to have contraceptives so you do not have an unwanted pregnancy. However, primary prevention can fail. Number one, the girl doesn't know that she or doesn't have avenues to get contraceptives. And some contraceptives do fail, by the way. It's not always 100% effective. Then the secondary prevention is the girl has become pregnant and she doesn't want the baby. It's an unwanted pregnancy. Then we offer what we call safe abortion. But because of the cultural religious realities, we cannot do this in most countries. I had great success in Nepal, in India, in Bangladesh, a Muslim country. I had great success. My maternal mortality in Nepal and Bangladesh went down dramatically by just giving safe abortion services. Then most countries cannot give that secondary prevention, which is safe abortion services. Then the girl go to some quacks, have an illegal abortion, come with life-threatening complications. Then we give tertiary prevention, saving her life, post-abortion care. That's where value clarification can come in as well. Some nurses, even some doctors say, kamu berdosa, you know, you deserve this or whatever. So it's very important that you must give compassionate care. The girl's life has to be saved. Okay, looking at it legally, if you look at the civil law, and Malaysia has both the civil law for the Muslims, they have the fatwa. Going by the civil law, the abortion law under the penal code in Malaysia is unique. Actually, I've never seen this anywhere else in the world. In most countries, it is abortion is not allowed unless it saves the life of the mother. In Myanmar, it's like that. In Sri Lanka, it's like that. There's nothing I can do. It's only saving the life of the mother. In Malaysia, the article says an abortion can be conducted by a registered medical practitioner without even needing a second opinion. So a doctor can conduct an abortion on a woman. The woman must give a written consent, and the abortion can be conducted if it affects negatively the life and the health of the woman. And that health includes mental health. So it is very liberal. The doctor, I mean, a woman can say, if I go on with this pregnancy, I'll be depressed. So the law allows him to do that. Then the Attorney General's office said, oh my God, we are giving you such a liberal law. We'll put a sub-clause. And the sub-clause is something that doctors are really crying foul over. If the woman, even after giving written consent, dies during the procedure, the doctor has committed a crime. So that's what the Malaysian penal code is. So if the girl is a Muslim, she and her parents want to be good Muslims and don't want to go against the religious ruling, then the fatwa says, if you miss your period, sebelum 40 hari, before 40 days, you can do the abortion with no conditions. Before 120 days, after fertilization, I mean, they can estimate that. Abortion can be allowed, the word is harus, can be allowed on condition. It threatens the life of the mother and the fetus. It's not or, it's and.
Okay.
So the fatwa is rather strict. And after 120 days, of course, it's not allowed at all. I mean, you do it, you commit a sin. So Malaysia is unique in that way. We have a rather liberal civil law. And a rather constrained or strict fatwa, yes.
Okay, so speaking of laws, we also need to address the fact that a number of these pregnancies occur in married teens, right? So child marriage continues to be very divisive, but the law is clear. Age of consent in Malaysia is 16. So individuals who are 15 or younger are not legally able to give consent to sexual activity. Which begs the question then, are parents who allow child marriages not accepting that if a marriage is consummated, a child marriage is consummated, they are basically being a party to statutory rape? Are they aware of the consequences, Azmi?
I think they're not aware, and that is not at all their concern because their daughter got pregnant. They have to save face. So the best thing, and they try followed by the law that they will go to Sharia court and get the approval and get married. And if we actually tell that to parents, they can actually just say, but I went to the court. which is the house of law. If it's wrong, they should have told me about it. So that's the other way out, I think, for parents. So I don't think they're aware. And to them, how the definition of rape in Malaysia might be different because rape to them means dipaksa, rogol, right? When our statutory rape is very protective, they don't see that part. How can you use such a negative word such as rape to be protective?
And I don't want to go into this, and I don't want to go into the idea of child marriage or discussing the topic of child marriage, because at the moment, all things being equal, it's still on the table in Malaysia, right? And that is a separate fight for a separate day. But what I want to know is, if child marriages are still taking place, Dr. Narima, is it possible that we can at least maybe clamp down on sexual relations for married teens before the age of consent?
I think that's a very, very good way of looking at it. Rather ideal, I would say, that let's separate marriage and sexual relation. Because for us in medicine, as a medical doctor, what we don't want is that a young girl becoming pregnant with very severe consequences. But what Syed Azmi says is one setting. That means the girl is already pregnant, so the mother, the father, the parents will want the child to get married, and she already had sex anyway. Now, if we go to the next setting of the girl is not yet pregnant, but the mother wants the young girl to be married, or for some reason or other. In fact, I suspect that when statements are made by some political leaders that kita boleh mengetatkan syarat-syarat untuk anak yang anak-anak yang dinikahkan. So what are those syarat? I think there was one case in Kelantan. It was, I think, that we suspected the parents wanted money. They were poor. Maybe the old man was offering money. That's where I think, if I want to put on my pragmatic hat, Sumitra, because ideally, I would want child marriage to end.
Yes.
But we cannot hope for the ideal situation to come. Not in the near future anyway. So your suggestion, I think, is a very, very good thing. Let's separate out. Let the marriage go on. But can we have something to do? Two things. Number one, to let the child go on in school. Her education must not be compromised. Number two, can she be put in a situation not to have sexual relations with that man? But the weakness there is, I assume this man is an adult man who wants sex with a young girl. So if we go by the assumption, that's tough. But it was a marriage between, say, a young boy or a young girl, or a young girl with a not so old man, and the man is willing to delay sex relations until the girl is an adult, that would be ideal. But I don't think it's going to be easy to do, but I wish it can be.
Yeah. If I can add, there are girls in our home, later they got married at still young age with the boy. So what we, of course, they are no longer in school, so it's all difficult. But what we suggest to them is to find, we actually find a couple who is like 20 or 30 years already in married, to become their buddy and mentors. Because then they will have issues. So they have someone to talk to actually guide them what is a marriage all about. Because they already got married. It's not something that they got pregnant, because of that they got married. So because of that, they don't know. They're not prepared, right? They're not prepared at all. It was shocking. So we put in a husband and wife mentor buddy system to help them, to make them see what is family, invite them to the house over Sundays to see what is eat together all about, and all, family values. Maybe that's also another way where we can get community to help to reduce stigmas and all that.
I'm speaking to Dr. Narima Awain, chairperson of the National Population and Family Development Board, and social activist Syed Azmi Al-Habshi about teenagers who get pregnant. We're going to take another short break. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back once again. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Sumitra Selvaraj. I'm speaking to Dr. Narima Awain, chairperson of the National Population and Family Development Board, and social activist Syed Azmi Al-Habshi about the rising numbers of adolescents who get pregnant. Okay, so actually, what are some of the resources available to teenagers who are pregnant? Who can they turn to? Who should they turn to?
Of course, looking at the needs of a pregnant woman, that pregnancy will have to be dealt with in the proper, you know, health, in a healthy way. And they must be encouraged to attend antenatal clinics, which at the same time can give them counselling as well. So I can only think of that at the moment, which they can attend in any of the government clinics or the Ministry of Health.
Mm.
But they can also, they're welcome to come to our cafe at teen in LPPKN, although they're already pregnant. And of course, we can only do counselling for them. So we do have counsellors in our cafe at teen.
Other than that, there's orphan care. There's a lot of other halfway home for pregnant girls. They just Google mengandung luar nikah, words like that. There's a list of home.
You yourself run halfway homes.
Yeah, I myself run. So they call us up. It's not that they need to go to a home. They just want advice, someone to talk to, and someone to actually... Sometimes it's just they couldn't even imagine going to a clinic kesihatan. They thought they need to see a gynae. And then they wanted to know what's the procedure like for them not getting married and then getting pregnant. You know, what happened to the boy? This kind of conversation, which I think LPPKN would be a good source to have as well. Because in hospital, if we say clinic kesihatan, the waiting time and all that, they might just go out. But there's a lot of any women's organization are also ready for them to call up. And it's not just for girls, I would like to say this. Even boys who know that their girlfriends are pregnant, they can also make the call. So it's really open. I think nowadays, a lot of NGO and government agencies are ready to accept this kind of inquiry. Honestly, they do.
Okay.
Talking of shelter homes, I know NGOs are doing a lot, but the welfare department does have shelter homes as well. The numbers are, I'm not sure about the numbers, I think they're not about 7 at the moment. And I really do not know what the utilization rate is like. So there is hope for, there is an opportunity or avenue for sheltering from the welfare department. The cafe at teen that I was saying that a pregnant girl can come and get counselling. If she doesn't want to physically come there, she can use an application. She can do it online. She can get counselling online as well.
Okay. Yeah. So in the course of kind of researching for this interview, I did go to the LPPKN microsite. You have a separate microsite for sex education on teenagers. It's called ACE, Accurate, Comprehensive and Effective. It seems like a rather odd name for a sexual education site for teenagers. Why are we not just saying that it's sex education? What is accurate, comprehensive and effective?
The more well-known module by the LPPKN is called Pekerti, which is Pendidikan Kesehatan Reproduktif dan Seksual. It's not really an acronym, but that one is more utilised. This one that you mentioned, I think it's rather recent. The Pekerti has been there for a long time and it's been used all over the place. But this one that we do, I think this one is just the principles. So Pekerti will have to use those three principles. That it has to be accurate and it has to be effective. What was this?
Comprehensive.
Comprehensive. So those are the principles that we use, that we have to use whenever we have our own modules. So we have the Pekerti module and there is something called the Mekar module as well, which also deals with the family, mainly in giving sex education.
Okay.
Yeah. So but it's more on the principles.
Okay. Yeah. So I wanted to go into something that I found on the website, which I think is perhaps a harbinger of how we approach sex education as a whole in this country, right? In the section under gender and sex, and the website is very well laid out. I found in this section under gender and sex, two drawings meant to show the difference between male and female bodies. Now, the male body didn't have any genitalia at all, even though in other parts of the site, you know, if got very specific mention of anatomical body parts. So, you know, if we can't show children who are looking for information about sex education what the parts look like, how can we be expected for them to understand how they function?
This is to me rather disturbing, because going one step backwards, what I used to complain about sex education in school was you're too concentrated on the anatomy. You only tell children these are the private parts and this, but you don't look at the psychosocial elements of sex education. That was my complaint. But now it looks like even the anatomy is not being dealt with accurately and correctly. And I think that's a shame and we have to correct that. In fact, in Sweden, they just don't go by drawings. They have mannequins. They have all kinds of, you know, models that people... That children can use to learn.
Are children looking for information about sex education online? Are they turning to online resource tools?
Under the word sex education, there's so many things that they look out for. If they say specifically that way on how to have sex, probably not.
Mm.
But if they're looking of safe sex, that is probably a bit different. And then I think famous keywords is about abortion, missing periods. These are the ones that the girls that I talk to, they always on the lookout.
Mm.
And then STIs, sexual transmitted illnesses or STDs, quite rare because they are just afraid of it. Because what
right.
if they wouldn't understand and they don't know how to even ask?
Mm.
Because opening up that site is it's actually a big problem.
Mm.
That is what, to my understanding, talking to the girls. However, for the boys, it's mainly pornography.
Mm.
So basically, they were searching. It's not like, were you searching to learn about sex? They were not specifically that way. It actually went straight to pornography.
Right. From the LPPKN standpoint, what are your views on abstinence versus comprehensive sexuality education?
Personally, and as chairman of LPPKN, it's not something that I would emphasize on. We will have to mention it somewhere, but it shouldn't be the first statement you make, because there is enough evidence to say the abstinence just doesn't work. Mm. It just doesn't work. So we, as policymakers, LPPKN, we have to accept that reality, that it just doesn't work. That's the harsh reality of life. But we can still encourage it. We can still mention it, but it shouldn't be the tagline of our sex education. It shouldn't be. When I was asked to chair the Sex Education Task Force way back in 2002 or 2003, and the representative from the religious department told me two things that made me disturbed. Number one, he was saying about, can you teach the boys whenever they have the urge to have sex, go and climb a coconut tree or go and play football, okay? So, memurnikan, the word he used to me is, you memurnikan your sexual urge. So, I didn't want to argue with him. The second one, I could argue with him, and he later on said, Dr. Narimah, I give up on you. He said, please put in your module, bukan sahaja zina itu berdosa, apa jua yang mendatangkan, yang mendekatkan zina juga berdosa.
Oh.
Ustaz, then you have to, I'm only chairing this committee. The teachers in schools are going to use these modules. Now, you have to tell the teacher, put an appendix somewhere in the module, inilah perkara-perkara yang akan membawa kepada zina. And it so happened, when I chaired that meeting, it was just a few weeks after that young couple was caught in KLCC for holding hands.
Right.
So you must say, perkara-perkara yang membawa kepada zina adalah seperti berikut. Berpegang tangan. Bercium. Bercium tu cium apa? Must be deep wet kissing or just ordinary kissing. Or tidak memakai tudung. Tidak menutup aurat.
Hmm.
So these are not easy to define. Apa dia? So he gave up on me. He said, no, I cannot give you that appendix. It's not possible. But my opinion in Sumatra is, whilst that is the ideal, we wish everyone can abstain, we know, like I said, it's all your hormones flowing, by the way. It's biological. So we have to deal with it by other means. Yeah. Abstinence is not the main thing here. But of course, we have to encourage it somewhere.
You brought up a very important point, right? Because in the BFM Health and Living event in October, you know, you were part of the town hall with Hannah Yeo, the Deputy Minister of Women, Family and Community Development. And, you know, she said that, you know, sex education currently being taught in schools is couched in the teacher's personal values, which is something that you've mentioned as well. So do we have a solution to this? You know, how can we successfully implement sex education that is truly effective? Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I was chairing that committee in 2002 or 2003, I started thinking about this. Number one, let's make a clear policy. Do we want sex education to be a subject or it is integrated with other subjects? And I believe it was integrated with physical education. So one day I tested it by asking my children. They were in primary school then. What do the teachers teach you under something called sex education? Oh, we only do that module when it rains because we cannot go to the field to do PE. So teachers, they prefer to use that subject only to do PE. So we know for a fact that it is neglected totally.
Mm.
About integration, there are many models of... I'm not the expert to say this, whether it should be or shouldn't be integrated. So integrating it in PE alone seems not to have worked. But what I saw in Sweden was very interesting. It's integrated into every subject. And I sat down for the French subject. And they were teaching children through a French poem. I knew a little bit of French language then, so I could understand the poem. And it was for 15-year-olds, I think. And the questions that were asked, it really inspired me. Like, what do you do when you first fall in love? Things like that. And one boy asked the teacher, when I want to give a gift to my girlfriend on Valentine's Day, should I give her red roses or should I give her a box of chocolates? Those are practical questions, you know. Like, very. And the girl said, and if my boyfriend says he really wants to have sex with me and I don't want to have sex with him, what do I tell him? So these are the things that I learned through one poetry in the French language. So jokes aside, I was saying, I would want to be the maths teacher and teach sex education. Then I would say, if a young boy needs 3 condoms a night and he has sex 7 days in a month, how many condoms does he have? And if you have evidence to say that one of the condoms out of 3 will have a hole in it, how would you, you know, you can do a lot of mathematics out of that simple things like condom use.
I dare say we'll see a spike in the interest in the subject of mathematics in school.
Yes, so it's... there are many, like I say, I'm not the expert to say what approach, but we do know what Hannah Yeo says, what YB Hannah Yeo says or suspected is not far from the truth. It is there, the modules are there, it is in the curriculum, they're supposed to teach, but it is not being taught optimally.
Okay.
And one of the reasons is personal values.
All right. So I'm going to wrap up this interview with asking you both a very, to me, very, very practical question. And it's a question that's going to start with a statement that is going to make me rather unpopular. We cannot stop children from having sex. They are having sex. It is a reality that everybody from parents to policymakers to the government to religious authorities need to accept. Children are having sex. But what needs to be done and what can be done in the next 5 years, for example. Let's give ourselves a goal. 5 years to reduce teen pregnancies. Me?
To me, it's actually to have a platform to actually talk about it openly. Children, I tend to, when we work with them, they tend to test us, the adult. So they would say something like, oh, Abang Syed, you know what? My friends bought the 28 ringgit condom, only have one condom in that box, cost 28 ringgit. And I asked him, like, really? Where did you get it? In 7-Eleven, it's the most expensive condom, the one condom only. And if I keep quiet and say, oh, okay, you have so much, a lot of money, and I walk away, they take that as acknowledgement. They just want to acknowledge that that doesn't surprise you, Abang Syed. It means that you're okay with me saying that, but they don't know how to start. These are boys. So down the line, if I said, really, I never knew they have only one. Every packet has 3. And basically, it doesn't cost that much. There's a cheaper version at 2.70 ringgit. Mm-hmm. So when I said, oh, really? We didn't know. Then they opened up. No, it was just thinking that if we say something, then we start talking about sex. And then that conversation end up, they were thinking about nobody would know in the house. So they thought wearing condom for masturbation. So they were thinking that make it clean. But they were thinking that way so much because they say if we wear condom, it would be cleaner. It's not in our bedsheet, so nobody knows. But I said, what's wrong if it's on your bedsheet? How do we explain? So you see, if we give that kind of explanation, it's not condoning anything. It was about them with all their insecurities and question mark addressed properly.
Understanding biological functions.
Yeah, that's what Dr. Narima starts with just now. Yeah.
So, Dr. Narima, your thoughts on a comprehensive plan to bring down teen pregnancies in the next 5 years?
In fact, Sumitra, way back, I think this was in 1989, I was working in one of the districts. I was at a meeting in one of the Yayasan Pembangunan Keluarga. And when I made that statement, children are having sex. Whether you like it or not, they are having sex. You cannot deny that reality. So what can we do about it? And of course, I wanted the response to be sex education. One of the persons in that meeting, and he's a professional. He's not an uneducated person. He's a professional. In fact, he does counselling. He said, one of the things we need to consider, maybe we bring down the age of marriage. So children are having sex anyway. Let's do something about it. These are the things we can do, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but bringing down the age of marriage is certainly not one of them. So back to comprehensive sexual education, value clarification, enabling environment, and a closer monitoring and accountability of what schools are doing. If you're supposed to teach this and you're not teaching, what's your accountability? So there must be some system of making these things work. I think we are too laid back. We are so happy, we're so proud to have a policy and a curriculum, but we're half-hearted about it. So we are not really tracking it. So that's not an easy question to answer. The reality is children are having sex. We have to do something about it. And these some things, in plural, that we have to do about it must be evidence-based scientifically, must be in line with the social cultural realities of the country. And I'm sure we can find some common platform. I don't think we can give up. There are times when I feel like giving up. I think there is still hope at the end. There is still light at the end of the tunnel. I think Malaysia can move forward towards dealing with teenage pregnancy. Children are having sex. Let's do something about it.
Thank you both for such a frank and insightful conversation. And this is a conversation that we will keep having over and over again. I've been speaking to Dr. Narima Awin, chairperson of the National Population and Family Development Board, and social activist Syed Azmi Al-Habshi about tackling the crisis that is teenage pregnancies in Malaysia. If you missed any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn segments, you can download the podcasts on our BFM app or on Spotify. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my. or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.